My name is Jay Gunn. I happen to also to be the first speaker, and welcome everybody to this session. And after this meeting, I guess I'll be the new incoming chair-elect, whatever that means, chair in training after this meeting for S11. So I really welcome ideas and your continued support to this session. If you have, I'll be helping Satish to run the next meeting. I guess after Long Beach, it'll be my turn to organize the symposium. If you have ideas, let me know. And let me see what else. I think all the speakers are here. And I guess after yesterday, we all know the rules. We only have 15 minutes. And so around 30 minutes or so, I'll stand up and give you a gesture that time is almost up. So let's hope we can all finish in 15 minutes. I was given this task to preside over this session. I had nothing to do with the title of the session. And it's really long, I guess. Looks like all our talks are really addressing the first part of the title. And I guess we'll start. I'll try to set a good example, but I'm not sure. My name is Jay. I'm with University of California, Riverside. And the talk I'm giving here really is a result of a PhD student who just finished a few weeks ago. And he's currently working at the California Department of Pesticide Regulation. And this study was done in collaboration with Tobio Jin, who is at UC Davis, and also King Go, who is at CDPR. And as we know, in the Central Valley of California, there's a lot of agriculture, and also there are a lot of dischargers. And for example, it was estimated that during the irrigation season, which typically run from April to October, for example, more than half of the water in San Joaquin River could be from irrigation return flow. That means the runoff from agricultural fields. So you can imagine that due to the intensive use of pesticides and fertilizers, there could be a lot of agrochemicals in the water. And for example, also, this slide just shows you the new trend in terms of pesticide use. And in terms of water quantity, as we know, insecticides by design, they have toxicity, acute toxicity. That's why I think they're more important. You can see that in California, at least, the use of OPs, organophosphates, has been decreasing. This is one of the counties. This happens to be the county where we did our experiment. And at the same time, the use of pyrethroids has been increasing very quickly, as you can see here. And both of these classes of insecticides have a highly acute toxicity to a lot of aquatic organisms. For example, just in San Joaquin Valley, for example, people showed that these chemicals have been found both in the sediment as well as in the water column for both class of chemicals. Therefore, there's a true need for best management practices to reduce pesticide use, pesticide loads from these return flows. Of course, one of the most feasible options when you talk about non-point source for such a large-scale area would be the use of wetlands. And in construct wetlands, for pesticides at least, few things can happen. One is a pesticide could just go through the system, and all pesticides can become attached or absorbed by the vegetation. And thirdly, pesticides can just settle with sediment particles and become retained in the wetland system. Once pesticides are retained, you can have pesticides can be just undergoing chemical or biological transformations. So hopefully that's what happens. That way you can really remove the pesticides from the environment. Well, what's so special about this study? Many studies have been done with regard to wetlands. And I think our study is unique in the sense that this is the first study that has been done to consider just the pyrethroids. There are a couple studies on vegetative ditches, but this is, in terms of scale, it's much larger. And also this study was done under real working conditions, real wetlands. And we have done monitoring for over 2 irrigation seasons. I did not do it, but my PhD student did it. And also in this same study, he did a lot of work to find out what really happens once the pesticides have been retained by the wetland, which is important. Unfortunately, given the time, I will focus on the first 2 aspects. I will just talk about the removal efficiency of pesticides in these systems, and also try to understand what caused the removal of pesticides in these systems. This is where we are. The study sites are really right east of the Bay Area. It's about 6 hours from UC Riverside. So my PhD student, I think he said he made at least 20 trips. Each trip is about 700 miles back and forth. You can imagine that's a lot of work. So we had 4 wetlands. And for wetland 2 and 3, he studied wetland 2 and 3 in the first season. Then he studied all 4 wetlands in the next, the 08 season. As you can see that these are real wetlands, and they are pretty large in terms of area, from 2.3 acres. Wetland 4 is 150 acres. That's very big areas. And also the drainage areas are pretty big and pretty real. And this is a configuration of wetland 2 and 3. They are attached physically, they're attached together. As you can see here, first of all, the runoff well goes through a sedimentation basin. And after the sedimentation basin, part of the runoff will be was directed to go through wetland 1, which has section 1 and section 2. And wetland 2 is straight, well, wetland 3, I mean, is straight. So it goes from here to here. He took samples at different sites, different locations, so he could estimate the removal efficiency. These are the test sites. Those are, we at the same time of taking samples, we also measured the flow rates, so we could estimate the load reductions. And one thing I wanted to emphasize here is, these are dynamic systems. So at different time of the year, these systems look very different. So it's all, always fancy to say wetlands, but once you get out there to work with them, it's not so easy. And so you can see that these wetlands really, the appearance of these wetlands changed over the months of the year, as well between years, as you can see here. Okay, now I'm going to report some of the results. I think it's only a portion of the results, and I just want to say that, these results have been published in a EST paper just recently, but he has maybe twice or 3 times more data. So this is how he calculated removal efficiency. First of all, he calculated removal efficiency based on concentrations. The outlet and the inlet, and that's the removal efficiency. And this is wetland 2 and wetland 3 for both years. As you can see here, for the first five are the pyrethroids. The last one is OP, it's a chlorpyrifos. You can see that removal efficiency for the pyrethroids are typically, based on concentration alone, are pretty good. For both years, and looks like the second year performed better than the first year. And this is for wetland 1 and 4. This study was done in 08. You can see again, when these chemicals were detected, The removal efficiency of these wetlands are really good. It's very good. And then, as I said, we measured also daily flow rates, and from which you can calculate the removal efficiency in terms of load reductions. As you can see here for the pyrethroids, the first five chemicals, you have somewhere from 95 to 100% removal. So these systems are very effective at removing these chemicals. And also the removal efficiency, even for OPs, are pretty good, especially for chlorpyrifos. And also he did, based on the sediment concentrations, he did some calculation of the sediment toxicity. For example, in the sediment basin, the sediment would have high toxicity to Hylala azteca, which is a benthic invertebrate. But by time you reach the outlet in both wetlands, outlet one, outlet two, the sediment toxicity would be below the LC50, much lower than the LC50. This really means that the water going out of the system should have no acute toxicity to a lot of invertebrates. Well, the next question is, what caused the removal? And he did a lot of work trying to understand, which I think is, again, one of the strengths of this study. And one thing he did is to look at the pesticides in the runoff water, the distribution, the phase distribution. You can see that a lot of these pyrethroids, they were associated with the suspended solids in the runoff water. So one of the mechanisms for the removal is sedimentation. When the water flows through the systems, the sedimentation happens due to vegetation, due to gravity, due to the sediment traps. You can see that's one reason, one of the reasons that we had such high removal. It's sedimentation. And also for this area, it's very strange. This area, you can see there's a lot of water infiltration into the groundwater. And for both, for example, you can see that most of the water losses over the summer, over the months, is due to infiltration. And that's important because you have a reduction in volume. Of course, this also has a concern for the potential for vertical transport of pesticides, contamination of groundwater, for example. But we looked a little bit into this, but hopefully CDPR can continue to support us. I have somebody from CDPR here, to look into this potential. I think it's really important. Hopefully these wetlands are not really causing problems for, not only insecticides, but also herbicides. So when you have the high reduction in terms of flow volume plus the sedimentation, that's how we got the high removals. So in conclusion, these wetlands, these working wetlands, they're real wetlands, they are very efficient at removing pesticides, especially pyrethroids. For example, based on concentrations, the reduction for pyrethroids was 52 to 94%. And for chlorpyrifos, it's about 52 to 61%. In terms of loads, for pyrethroids, we always had more than 95% removal. And even for organophosphates, we had a pretty high removal. And also, the sediment toxicity was reduced to below LC50 values after the wetlands. So with that, that's the conclusion of my talk. Let me see how I did. Very good. We have time for a couple questions.
Yes? I'm assuming that most of those compounds have pretty high partitioning coefficients.
Yeah, especially pyrethroids. The KLC is somewhere 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6.
Are you going to look at any compounds with lower KDs, see if you can get some mechanism of retention in that weapon or something that's less sorted?
That's a good question. We had diazinon in there. Diazinon was not is not especially hydrophobic compared to chlorpyrifos. You can see that the removal for chlorpyrifos was better than diazinon. Diazinon was not too great, about 50%, 60%. Definitely, I think, you know, that's, I think would be interesting also to look at the removal of herbicides. Its use is higher for, you know, for that area than insecticides. I think it would be very interesting as well. Yes, Sudan. I won't say that. These wetlands, they are typically dry when it's not, when they're not irrigated. So the only water that coming into these wetlands is from the return flow, the runoff from agricultural fields. And these wetlands, they are there, you know, and also I heard one of them, for example, is a duck hunting pond. And, you know, people set them aside and they are there. Probably, you know, there are many more of them in Central Valley. Okay, Minhua.
How the flow was measured?
Was measured with a pressure transducer. It was done by Toby Ogin's group. Okay, one last question, I guess. Okay.
On your photographs, you show how the, they change pretty dramatically throughout the year. Your ponds, I mean, wouldn't volatility be a big concern in that case?
You know, these pesticides, they are not known for their volatility. And I would say, you know, vapor loss or emission should be pretty minimal. And given their chemical, physical properties, I would say, even when it's dry. Okay, I guess we'll move on. Thank you. And we'll move on to our next speaker.